Version. You can read along in your bulletins. God standeth in the congregation of the mighty. He judgeth among the gods. How long will ye judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? Selah. Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Rid them out of the hand of the wicked. They know not, neither will they understand. They walk on in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are out of course. I have said, ye are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High. But you shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for thou shall inherit all nations. This is the word of God.
Thank you, Sandy. This psalm is most famous, not really for what it says, because different parts of the Bible stand out to different people, but it is most famous for how it was used by Jesus later on. In John chapter 10, Jesus is revealing himself to be the Messiah, and he's accused of blasphemy because he says that he and the Father are one. And in response, he refers people back to this psalm. He says, is it not written in your law, I said, ye are gods? And the psalm doesn't talk about what it means to be gods. It doesn't talk about what it means to be a child of the Most High. Instead, it takes these things simply as given. We can debate the meaning of gods, who it's intended for, and children of God, but the main point of the psalm is pretty straightforward. It simply tells us what we should do. Judge justly, reject all that is wicked, help the poor, and help the defenseless. It's a good set of instructions, but it's still easier said than done. I've been up here twice before. Each time I felt like I had a certain message to give. This time I was asked, and I felt that I was lacking inspiration. And what I do often when I'm lacking inspiration, I turn to the Bible. Among the selections for today was this psalm. And that point, ye are gods, ye are children of the Most High, stands out simply because it is taken for given and taken for granted and or simply listed as a base for everything else. And many people debate what it means. So some of the inspiration comes from knowing that we are children of God. Some of the people that best exemplify that are what we call saints. Outside, the sermon says sinners, saints, and us, but I'll give it away. I'm not going to talk much about sinners. It would be too easy, and we could be here way too long. the us, is kind of because it sounded better, but really any sermon should have something to do with us, because if it doesn't, well, what's the point, right, if we can't use it? But the saints are something that I find to be inspiring to me. If someone is a child of God, they should be able to have saintly actions at some point, whether temporary or not. So today's sermon is really about saints, people that have done their best to follow God's instructions, whether those instructions came from the text or right from prayer. And I think all of us can learn something from them. It's hard to talk about saints without talking about the Roman Catholic Church. Some Protestants go so far as to even say that saints are really just a Catholic thing altogether. It makes sense. They get a lot more press. The Catholic Church has a big process for recognizing a saint. They have calendars. They have feast days. They have amulets, souvenirs. They have so much that it makes a person wonder if it's a reason for worldly people to celebrate holy people or an excuse for religious people to be less so for a few days and sell a few souvenirs. But saints themselves were around long before the Catholic Church, long before days for feasting of them. And even the Catholics never pretended to actually create or make saints. Their whole process is really about acknowledging them formally. And saints existed in the Jewish tradition and in Christian life before the Catholic Church. The Old Testament will have hundreds of references to saints. The New Testament has at least 60, depending on your translation. Paul, in his epistles, the letters to Romans, Colossians, Galatians, Ephesians, and others, opens his letter by addressing them to the church leaders and calling them saints, you saints who are serving Christ. These are common people who have simply organized their local churches, and he calls them saints. And that's right there in the Bible. Our own Methodist hymnal has prayers from St. Francis, St. Ignatius, and St. John Chrysostom. So the definitions of saints can be varied, and people can have different definitions. The Catholics have one. The Bible has others. But instead of trying to sort them all out or go back to Greek and Hebrew and trying to make a very precise definition, I'd rather just focus on what they mean to us, their role. To me, a saint is a person that inspires with their example of their life, a person that has integrated so much of God's Spirit into their own life that other people can see it, can feel the holiness, even if it only comes out sometimes. In Galatians, that letter from Paul, the church leaders had many faults. That particular chapter is often looked at as resolving conflicts among Christians. They had disagreements with each other, but Paul called them all saints anyway, without sorting them out, because they were all doing their best to serve Christ, and they were all working to establish the faith in their city, missionaries in different ways, even though they all worked differently, and even though they disagreed with each other. So today I wanted to highlight a few examples of saints that we can look to, people who in one way or another inspired enough people that gives us mortals a glimpse beyond and lets us talk about them hundreds of years later. I'd like you all to look at the cover of your bulletin. It's kind of a different cover than we usually have. This is a pretty famous painting of St. Joseph of Cupertino. That's Cupertino, Italy, not California. He was famous, and he was made a saint for floating, for levitating, not really for flying. He didn't leap over tall buildings or fly where he wanted. Instead, he was mostly a normal person. I say mostly because aside from people saying he levitated, he was also very well known for being a very simple-minded person, even a little bit stupid and kind of grumpy. He wanted to be a priest in one sect, and he was rejected because he wasn't educated enough. He joined another, and he got kicked out because of his grumpy nature. But he was attracted to religious life, and he was very devoted. And that first sect that wouldn't let him join did let him sweep the barns. And after many years of that, doing his task with great humility, they finally allowed him in and trained him for priesthood. And so he joined the group prayers with the other monks. And during prayer time, he would float, mostly within the church, within the actual building. But sometimes, apparently, he would float away long distances across the countryside. It's a funny image. It makes you think, what would you do today if you saw somebody drifting down Magnolia Boulevard? I don't really know, but I've seen enough news reports to know that somebody would call the police, and that's what happened to him. He was turned into the Inquisition for being a sorcerer. So actually, even though this was the 17th century, there's a trial record for him where there's many witnesses who swore, you know, in court, as much of a court as they had, that he would levitate and he would float, and then he was not subjected to any prosecution because he only floated during Mass and during his prayers. So in the end, there it is. It's a very strange gift, I suppose, but it was notorious. It made him very famous. Enough so that people said, you know, there must be something in this prayer. They saw a real example of otherworldly things that could happen to people. Anytime you read about a saint or a miracle, it's important to be careful about the source. A lot of sources have an active desire to discredit miracles, especially miracles that are so fantastic that you can't repeat them under scientific conditions. And other sources have just as strong an interest in promoting them. In the end, everybody has to make their own decision. I'd like to think that even though these eyewitnesses lived in the 17th century, it was the age of Isaac Newton, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Saint Joseph. Even though they lived long ago and did not have the same PhDs we recognize today, I think they could tell the difference between a skilled gymnast and a person who mysteriously rose. And I also trust that they knew that lying to the court was pretty serious and they could get in real trouble for it. But in the end, I didn't see it. I wasn't there. It's an article of faith. And everyone should come to their own decision. For St. Joseph, we don't need to make a decision. Our decision will come if we do see someone floating down Magnolia Boulevard or lifted up here, apparently unable to come down until the priest commands him to. Another example that I thought of is St. Ignatius. He's from the 16th century. He was from a noble family, and he wanted to be a military hero. He had some success. He was even promoted in military combat. But in another battle, he was gravely injured. Both legs were injured, and one was partially amputated. In his long recovery, he became a strong convert. For the first time, he began to read, and he read a book called The Life of Christ. And he decided to become a hermit for a time. He developed his own method of exercises to grow closer to Jesus every day. It was a method similar to Methodism, where from 8 to 9 he would pray, from 9 to 10 he would worship, from 10 to 11 he would be on his knees, and from 11 to 12 he would do something that in this age is discredited, but back in his time it was common to think you could reach God by hurting yourself, by putting himself in chains to deny the material world and come closer to God. But he developed a very rigid method for this within the Catholic framework, with great discipline and great asceticism of fasting and denying pleasures of the flesh. He believed that convincing other people required an education, and so at the age of 38, he started school. And he got his master's degree at the age of 44. And he thought that would help him spread the gospel through reason instead of through force. He founded a society of a few friends, six of them. It was called the Society of Jesus. He was pretty widely ridiculed by his townspeople. They called him the Jesuits, which, because he was from Spain, turned out to be the Jesuits, what we call today. And it was a scornful term at first, but he kept working regardless. This group that started with six people based on a strong discipline eventually formed an army of Christians to convert people. And now they have hundreds of universities and thousands of high schools around the world, in every continent except Antarctica, aside from doing extensive missionary work. Jesuits have had plenty of controversy, but the influence is astounding and undeniable. If anybody over 40 needs inspiration, St. Ignatius has a lot to offer. Another that I have found very inspiring myself is St. Francis. I don't have much in common with him, but I find a lot to admire. He started his life as the son of a wealthy merchant. As a youth, he was a troubadour, basically partying like a frat boy around town, a musician, colorful clothes. He became a successful apprentice in his father's business. He also had dreams of honor and glory, of being a war hero. His first try at it resulted in a year in the enemy's dungeon, and eventually being set free by ransom. His second try, a few years later, he still wanted another go at it. He left again for battle with apparently a very expensive suit of armor, and he had a vision to turn around, that wasn't for him. And as a result of that vision, he gave away his very expensive suit, which annoyed his father a great deal, and turned around and went back home. After a number of other things, he fell out with his father. He left the house, he abandoned his family entirely, and left the town naked and penniless. He was told in a vision to rebuild the church. Today, as we look back at the life of St. Francis, many people say that that was to rebuild the Catholic Church, to put faith at the center of religion rather than politics and power. The Catholic Church had been very corrupt. But at the time, he didn't know that. He just heard those words, and he didn't really know what to do. He had been taking refuge in an abandoned shell of a church, something that had been left alone for many years. And when he heard, "Rebuild my church," he went out and started picking up rocks, asking people for charity, for materials to build mortar, and started building the church again with no other tools than his hands and the rocks of the field. He restored three abandoned churches this way. And if you go to Italy today, you can still see them. He became both a beggar and a charitable giver, begging for food and giving it to others, and also helping anyone with a need. If your cart was stuck by the side of the road, he would help pull it. If you were starving, he would beg and he would give you food. He himself would fast. Over many long years, the townspeople that scorned the rich boy who gave it up to be a bum, but who also helped people in any condition at any time, eventually came to respect him. He preached God's love to everyone. He had three simple orders for what became the Franciscan Order of Monks, and that was poverty, chastity, and I forgot the other one right now, and I didn't write it down, but those two were most of them. And he never owned anything. Anytime that people gave him things, he would say it wasn't his, and he would rush to give it away to whoever he could. He was known for preaching, for speaking to animals. So maybe, Greg, that'll come in handy. And famous paintings of him show him when he's preaching to the birds. There is one event in which he saw all the birds on a hill as being representative of God's love. He saw God in everything, the sun, the moon, the stars, the trees, the grass, and the birds. And he rushed to preach to the birds to praise their beauty, to praise their obedience to God. And as that happened, birds came flocking to him. So many of the paintings of St. Francis have him standing there with birds perched on his arms and coming around him. He also would preach in large halls that were similar to barns. You know, the cathedrals in Europe can be enormous, and some of them had lots of birds in the wings, and when he began to preaching and the birds were saying, he asked them to please be quiet, and they did. They were all silent, and that probably made the people pay a lot more attention too. Of modern saints, he is often called one of the most Christ-like because he only offered love and charity to everyone. He also received the stigmata late in his life. They say there are more biographies of St. Francis than of any other person in history. The Bible, of course, would be one biography repeated many times, but St. Francis would have many, many different people who have written about him. I don't know if that's true, but there's a lot of them. And I encourage anyone to read more about him. The last saint that I will highlight today is a man by the name of Ananias. There are a number of people in the Bible named Ananias, but this one only appears in one place, in Acts chapter 9. We don't know much about him. We don't know how he grew up, what his influences were. All we really know is that he was living in Damascus, that he was a Christian, which at that time was flat out against the law. And he was told to go visit Saul, the man who had come to town to arrest Christians. I was trying to think of a modern parallel to this. And, of course, there is nothing that's exactly the same, but I thought of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. How many people know who he is? He's a sheriff in Arizona who is known for being extremely strict on illegal immigration, among other things. He's also known for being quite cruel and merciless. One thing that he did is all of his prisoners have pink jumpsuits. And I heard him on TV talking about how he bought pink, not because it was cheaper, not because there was anything about being able to see prisoners escaping, but rather he said it was really to humiliate people. After they were arrested and after they were in prison, he wanted them to be more humiliated still, and that he would do more if he could. So he's an interesting fellow. You know, being an illegal alien is very different from being a Christian. A Christian is a calling of the heart. The condition of illegal alien is something different from that, but I was trying to imagine the same consequences for responding to a vision, and I can only imagine a very dark-skinned Mexican receiving a vision telling him to go see Joe Arpaio, to go walk down the street, walk into the sheriff's office, and go confront this man who is famous for persecuting people just like him. Now, again, it's not an exact example, but the consequences are very clear. And at the time, Ananias didn't know that he'd be in a book called the Bible that we're reading 2,000 years later. That book, you know, was not composed for hundreds of years afterwards. He had no historical context. He just received the vision, and he acted on it. We don't know what he did afterwards. He may have no consequence. He may have no idea of the consequences of his action beyond that immediate time when he went to Saul, and Saul became able to see once again and started preaching about Christ. We don't know what happened to Ananias after that. That may, you know, in the Bible, that's where his story ends. But of course, he was a normal person living a normal life at the time, and perhaps he never even knew that Saul went on to become Peter and preach Christ and make many, many converts. Paul, sorry. Oh, yeah, there we go. But he may not have known that at all. We can imagine the story in a different way if he had simply refused the vision, if he said, you know what, I'm going to get arrested. I'm going to step away from that. Then we'd have a different story. It would be like the story of Jonas, who was given a mission and turned away, and he ran away. We might have Saul blinded for a number of years while Ananias was taken in by a whale, spewed out, ran around trying to escape God's instructions. We don't know, but he was courageous. He took up his cross, he took up that challenge, and he went and he delivered the message, and Saul became Paul, and the rest, of course, is there. But he is a saint. He's a saint by the definition of Paul in his epistles, as he writes to anyone who is a Christian. And he's a saint by the definition of the Catholic Church. He's Ananias the Second, because there was another Ananias that came first in the Bible. But he was simply a person who ignored worldly signs and responded to God. I think that can be an inspiration to any of us. So really, I'm sharing these stories in the hopes that we can see that different people with different gifts can become something great simply by being devoted or by being open to God. Joseph was a simpleton who simply prayed. Ignatius was a decommissioned soldier who turned his gifts to become a soldier of God and education. Francis was a beggar, but enraptured by God at all times. And Ananias was someone near anonymous, a simple Christian who followed a difficult God-given instruction at an important time. Aside from these, obviously there are many, many more saints, including men and women with gifts as diverse as all humanity. All of them touched by holiness to one degree or another that was so evident that we still talk about them. I really simply just ask that we can all pray that we can ourselves at some point witness that holiness in the people we meet and the people that fill our days as we go to work and meet our friends day in and day out. Look for that holiness, seek it out, and it shall be found. And now, let's pick up the hymn book again for our closing hymn, number 708, Rejoice in God's Saints.